Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
And away we go on the Patrick Madrid Show on a Taco Tuesday. Muchas enchiladas to everybody. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's start off with Jay in California. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you, Patrick?
Doing
I have
well,
a question. My 16-year-old son, we discovered this weekend, has renewed a social media account, which he's been asked several times before to end. So that's one thing. Second of all, we discovered that some of the media that he's been putting on there, the memes, the videos that he's been sharing with some of his friends, are vulgar and upsetting. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious whether I should be reaching out to any of his friends who we do know that he's sharing them with, to his parents, to their parents, rather, and letting them know that their children are receiving these things from our son. Mm-hmm. So, but first and foremost, what can we possibly say to our son who, again, has done this despite being told several times before? And he doesn't have a phone. Doing this
How's he
on
doing?
The school laptop.
Okay.
We have a school laptop, so when he gets on there to do his schoolwork, I'm assuming he's going there. And he's also asked to use our phones to listen to audiobooks for schooling and discovered that that's when he's apparently getting online as well.
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right. So this is a very common thing. I have direct experience with this, I'll put it that way. And so, you know, I definitely empathize with your concern, and it's maddening. It's frustrating. It is like, what is it going to take, kid, for you to stop doing something that, whether you realize it or not, is bad for you? I can imagine the emotions that you and your husband are feeling as you're dealing with this, because
yeah,
I've been through it myself. Okay. So I'm with you. I'm on the same page as you. So if you don't mind, I'd like to begin by saying how wonderful it is to hear from you as a mom that you and your husband did not give your 16-year-old son a smartphone. That is like handing a child a stick of dynamite. And it is as surely as night follows day, these situations happen routinely where it's insanity, if you ask me. Now, this doesn't affect you personally, but it's insanity for parents to give children, and I'm talking about like grammar school age children, to give them smartphones. And even if the parent thinks that he's got it locked down with great filtering software, these kids know how to get around it. And all they have to do is log on to YouTube and watch the tutorial videos on how to get around the filtering software. So they're smart, they're adept with technology. And that's why parents, if you're giving your kids smartphones, you're in for a world of problems, and your children are in for a world of problems. So please don't do it. And I know it's countercultural, and I know the kids are going to complain and jump up and down and throw a tantrum, and all their friends have phones, and how come their friends can have TikTok, but I can't have TikTok? Stand your ground. And eventually, the tough times, you'll get through it, and you will have helped your children get past a very dangerous time in their lives, especially if they have a smartphone. So as for you, Jay, in your particular son, he's 16 years old, so he's exhibiting devious behavior. So it's not as though he's simply complaining, you know, how come I can't do it when everyone else gets to do it? He's still doing it. So he's defying your parental authority. And I'm assuming, although you didn't say so, I'm assuming that you and your husband probably explained to him till you're blue in the face why he shouldn't be doing this. It's not merely saying you can't do it, but I'm sure you've explained to him why he can't do it because of the harms that are involved. Is that right?
Yes. And we've done this several times before. That's why I thought, okay, what can I possibly say? Should I even say anything? I mean, what is there to say?
Yeah. Well, there are some, it's like putting sanctions on Putin. I'm not comparing your son to Vladimir Putin. That was probably a misapplication of an analogy. But the whole idea of sanctions, we'll leave it like that. You just tell him, listen, hey, I mean, I'm assuming, does he have his driver's license yet?
Just got it.
Oh, see, I would have used that. I would have used that. I would have said, well, you can still do it. But what I would have said to him is, listen, if you want your driver's license or your permit for that matter, you have to stop doing this. And we're not going to allow you to get your driver's license until this ceases. Now, he's got his driver's license now, so you can still use that as a deterrent by saying, the next time this happens, next time we see it, you're losing your driver's license for a month. And make it hurt. Not because you want to hurt him, but you want him to... Sometimes change will not happen. Often it won't happen unless there's some pain involved. So if he's really into having his driver's license, if that's really important to him, then I would say that gets revoked the next time this happens and your license goes away for a month. And then it happens again, it goes away for 2 months. And if it happens again, it goes away for 3 months. Now, that kind of pain for a 16-year-old is likely to get his attention. Now, there may be other things that you can place sanctions on. I don't know what other things he's interested in doing, but this is a time when you've tried to reason with him. You've explained to him why this is wrong. You've told him you are not allowed to do this. And so he's jumped all of these fences. He has defied your authority and your husband's authority to tell him not to do it. So I think now you're in the sanctions phase where you just let him know, if you keep doing this, here's what's going to happen. Now, that is going to cause some heartburn. That's going to cause you some anxious moments, and there will be some confrontations, and he'll probably, if he's like any other 16-year-old, he's going to complain, and you know, this is just part of adolescence. But my advice would be to stand your ground. Don't give in. Don't give in to go along to get along. And the reason is not because I'm advocating parental inflexibility. I'm not advocating that parents should be iron-fisted or not understanding or any of those things. I'm not at all advocating that. But this is such a potentially devastating scenario for any young person because of the porn, because of the ideologies that are running rampant on these social media platforms, not to mention the fact that there are people out there who are actively seeking your 16-year-old son. They're actively pinging and looking for him. And when they find him, they have all kinds of plans for him. So
brings me to my concern.
All right.
Yes, it brings me to my concern that some of the memes and some of the videos that he's been sharing with friends are disturbing. They're not pornographic, but they're crass. They're vulgar. I'm disturbed by them, and I'm disturbed that my son is sharing this with his friends, and that some of his friends who we know and have watched grow up are likewise sharing back with him.
Let me offer just one thing to consider, Jay. Part of the, and this is not to excuse it at all. I'm not excusing it, nor am I condoning it, but part of this is adolescent males. Adolescent males from about the third, fourth grade, they're not adolescents then, but that's usually when the boys start up with, you know, the scatological jokes. They find it very funny. And, you know, the crude and the gross out humor. It's just part of that psychology, for better or for worse, in our culture sort of exacerbates that problem. So I'm not excusing it. I'm just saying part of it, if you take the long view, is you'll realize that he's going through a phase in his life where for adolescent boys, this is the epitome of hilarious for them. And he'll look back on it later and say, how stupid. You know, I used to laugh at that. That's kind of dumb. But that's part, I think, of what you're experiencing. And that's why his friends are doing this too, because they're in that same age range.
Okay. Do I have any sort of obligation to some of these friends to speak with their parents?
I think you are within your rights to do that. I don't know that you have a strict obligation to do so, but I don't think you'd be going beyond your purview if you were to say, you know, call up the mom of you know, one of the other kids and say, I don't know if you know what's going on with the kids and their phones, but here's what we found on our son's phone, and it involves your son. And, you know, we know you okay. and your husband don't approve. We just wanted to make you aware of it because our son's going through this situation and we're clamping down, but we wanted to make you aware of it. I think that's actually a very thoughtful thing to do.
Okay, very good. All right.
What about
the
school, though?
I appreciate your advice.
You're welcome. One final question. What about the school? Is the school laptop something that you can add filtering software to on your own, or would you have to do that through
the school? Actually, we homeschool, so it's a personal laptop. It's our family laptop, which is in the living area. So I guess this is what is a little bit more disturbing, is a lot of this is being done, like you said, deviously. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming going into private mode.
There are a million and one ways for them to cover their tracks.
And they are so much smarter than I am on technology that I can't mm-hmm. even figure it out. I mean, again, we discovered this just by accident because he didn't log out of this social media. And it's the same social media that I have, which I actually went on this weekend, the first time in months, went on there and discovered his account because he'd left it open on my phone. Or actually, yeah, he'd left it open. So
typical rookie mistake on his part. And I'll bet he'll, I bet he learned his lesson. So, yeah, if you don't mind extending the conversation for just another moment, Jay, I would say this, that since that's the homeschool-related laptop, I would lock that thing down with a couple of programs. One is called Accountable to You. And by the way, I have no connection with any of these companies. I've used them before as a consumer, and I found them helpful. So Accountable, the number 2U.com. What I like about that program is that, and it's been years since I've used it on with my youngest son, but I'm sure it's much more robust now than it was then. But this is tied into your and your husband's cell phone. Not that it's governing your cell phone, but any move he makes on that computer, you're immediately notified if it's outside the bounds. So if he does a search for something, if he goes to a website, if he tries to download a social media app, if he tries to access social media, now, you may have certain areas where he's free to do that, but if he goes outside of what you permitted, you get a text message in real time that says, look where he's going, look what he's looking for, look what he's looking at. And you and your husband will have that instantaneous control. The other thing is, you can, with a push of the button, push of a screen on your phone, you can just simply kill the internet on that device. You can kill particular apps on that device. You can set time restrictions. Okay. You know, it's only accessible on the internet during this time and this time. There are many different things you can do, and so you can really gain control. A second one, and this has to do more with pornography, but that's, I mean, if he's looking at crude memes, the chances are pretty good that if he hasn't already, he's going to be venturing down that path. And that is a filtering software called Covenant Eyes, and it is specifically designed.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Sure, Covenant Eyes, E-Y-E-S.
Covenant Eyes, okay.
Right. So that is a filtering software that is designed specifically for that problem, but it has many of the same kinds of features. The other one is broader, and it covers just things in general. But Covenant Eyes is an accountability software package that will help him have to have accountability to you and your husband. So I would recommend these things to you. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me about this. This is a problem that so many parents are facing right now. And I'm really,
you're welcome.
I was considering for
one of the consequences, just to take him off completely off of all the laptop and for the next month to allow him or require him to do all of his schoolwork the way I did growing up, just using books and handwriting papers.
Yeah.
So I figured maybe that's a way to get him to understand that these are just tools and should just be used as tools. And he'll really feel that if we take it away.
Yeah, I would concur with you. I would concur.
All righty. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jay. Good talking to you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Sam in Texas. Hi, Sam. Hello, Sam.
Yes, hello. Good morning,
yes,
sir.
Hi.
And I want to especially greet your guardian angel, Patrick.
Oh, thank you.
My question has to do with baptism. If the priest or deacon in baptizing a female, if he substitutes the word queen for king, does that make it invalid?
Well, you're talking about the baptismal rite, the ritual, right? Not just the words of baptism itself. Is that what you mean?
Yes, where one is made a priest, prophet, and king.
All right. Okay, well, no, it doesn't invalidate it because the essential ingredients for a valid baptism do not extend to the rest of the ritual. It doesn't extend to the rest of the ritual. That doesn't mean that the priest or the deacon should not follow that ritual faithfully. He should. This is where the problem of freelancing comes in. It's not his property to customize. He doesn't have the right to customize the wording to suit his own whims and preferences. But nonetheless, that doesn't invalidate the baptism because as long as there's the valid form, which is I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and as long as there is the valid matter, which is water, which is typically poured over the person's head and the intention to baptize, it's a valid baptism. Even if goofiness happens around all that, it would not invalidate the baptism.
It just sounded so disturbing, but I understand now. Thank you. Patrick.
You got it. I appreciate the phone call. Thank you. Yeah, just another public service announcement. Let's not forget, everybody, that the church's sacraments as given to her by Christ and as established by Christ, they are nonetheless not my property. It's not Father McGillicuddy's property. He doesn't have the right. You know, the good deacon does not have the right to freelance and customize the rite of the sacrament to suit his own preferences. So hopefully this is not a terribly widespread problem, but to the extent that it does happen, it is a problem. It's also confusing for lay people, you know, because it seems to suggest that all of these things are malleable and they're simply whatever I want them to be. And that's certainly never been the case. Let's go to, oh, I'm sorry, not Cecilia, Claudia in Red Bank, Tennessee. Hi, Claudia.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Patrick, I have a 23-year-old who unfortunately got into the internet too deeply for my taste. And the other day he said to me, he's definitely having years of faith crisis, mm-hmm. and having been raised Catholic and kind of denies all faith at this time. He's searching, no question. Okay. And the other day, as he left my car at night, he said, "Hey, how can you ever believe in a God who allows genocide? In the Old Testament, God was always killing people. I think it's terrible for God to have ever killed children or other or great groups of people." And I've been thinking about it, and I appreciate your show this morning because I was jotting down other thoughts I have about why I still continue to believe in God, even though I know that there's been days when people who were off the path were dead. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think that his argument carries.
This is not my show. Yes, go ahead, please.
Sure. I didn't mean to talk over you. I think that this particular question, how can you believe in a God who would allow for the indiscriminate death of innocent people? Furthermore, how can you believe in a God who would command the death of people, including innocent people? How can you believe in that God? Well, I approach the topic this way. Number one, I think that that has a lot of emotional impact for people nowadays because people are very concerned with fairness and equity and rights and things like that. And we should be concerned with all those things. I don't mean to say otherwise. But the thing we have to, I believe, the thing we have to consider is if God exists, and I believe he does,
mm-hmm.
if God exists,
yeah, me too. Yeah.
Then he's the source of all things that exist. Everything that exists comes into existence either directly or indirectly because of God. And so for me to say, well, because he's not doing things the way I personally feel is fair, is ludicrous, because I'm not God. I didn't create the universe. I didn't make the rules. I don't govern life and death. God does. I don't. So that's the first thing. Is, you know, it's a form. It's a really pronounced form, I would say, of pride, of we as human beings saying, because we wouldn't do something a particular way, therefore God is quote unquote wrong if that's the way he does it. It's just foolishness, if you ask me. The second thing is, it strikes me as though people lose sight of the fact that God is not the way we are, insofar as, you know, we are obliged to follow certain moral precepts and principles because we're creatures. And because, not being God, we don't have a say in when somebody comes into existence. You know, God is the one who creates the soul and unites it with the body at the moment of conception. And if God doesn't do that, no human being comes into existence. So we don't have that prerogative. We don't have the prerogative to determine when somebody dies. And we don't know the reality of God's plan of salvation and his providence, which is the same thing, and how it's unfolding, and how things to us that appear to be unjust or be unfair may, in the bigger picture that God sees, be perfectly placed, although it's difficult for us to understand. So this sense of human pride in presupposing that we know better than God does is ludicrous, if you ask me. So when I survey the Old Testament with all of its examples of the flood of Noah, for example, think about all the little bitty babies and all the children and all the good people who were on planet Earth who weren't doing anything wrong. And yet, because God punished the evil people and the good people suffered as a result of that, this is part of God's justice. Whether we like it or not, this is part of God's justice. And it's his role as God to determine these things. Now, I'm out of time. I'm actually over time, Claudia. So let me refer you to a book that I think will take you much deeper, and it's helpful because it gets into a lot of these specific things, like how can God command the destruction of the Canaanites? What about that? The book is called Is God a Moral Monster? By Paul Copan, C-O-P-P-A-N. Is God a Moral Monster? Now, the answer to that rhetorical question is no, he's not. But in that book, biblically, he goes through and demonstrates some of the things that I think that I don't have time to talk about now, but you could talk about with your son. Thanks for the question. Quick time out. I'll be right back.
Connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
All right. Welcome back to the program. About a half an hour left to go, so let's do it to it. Let's go to Sue in Forest Lake, Minnesota. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if you can point me to a resource. I had a conversation with my brother-in-law, who's a fallen away cradle Catholic. We were talking about abstaining from meat on Fridays during Lent, and he said that he insisted that it was because many, many years ago there was a shortage of meat and that the Catholic Church instituted this practice as a way to aid with that. And I told him that I believed that to be incorrect. I thought it was, my understanding has always been we abstain from any flesh meat to recognize what Christ did for us and his crucifixion. Can you help me with that? Can you? Okay.
Sure. Yeah, it's an untrue legend. So I've heard this before, too. I've heard various versions of this. I've heard before some people that, well, Pope so-and-so 1,000 years ago or whatever, he wanted to help the Catholic fishermen who were languishing in their business. So he said no meat on Friday so that everybody would eat fish and help the Catholic fishermen. And there's no basis at all in history for that. So these are just wives' tales. And the basis of this comes from, I mean, among other things, we see that Jesus himself fasted for 40 days in the desert. So not only did he not eat meat, he didn't eat any food at all in the 40 days of his preparation for his public ministry. And we see Jesus preaching simplicity of life and doing penance. And we see St. Paul, for example, talking about, I believe I quoted this earlier, where he says, I buffet my body and make it my slave, lest I who have preached to others may myself be disqualified. So there is a thread running through the New Testament of mastering your passions and your appetites by denying yourself. So this is a form of that that the church has embraced from the very beginning. So the idea of abstaining from meat is an ancient custom, an ancient practice that I would say goes back to apostolic times. It's not something that over time the church figured out, well, it'd be a great way to help someone's business, or it would be a great way to, you know, lessen the burden for the butchers because there's not enough meat. Those are just oddball tales that people have picked up along the way. They're certainly not part of the reason for this.
Sure. He was, his reply to me was, Sue, it's true. Ask Google. I thought, okay, well, we know where his head's at then.
Google will also tell you that men can be women and women can be men. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Patrick. God bless you.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate the call, Sue. Let's go now to, where are we going to go? Let's go now to Susanna, from Sue to Susanna in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hi, Susanna. I'm sorry. Hi, Susanna.
Hi there. I have a question about praying the rosary. There are some days where I am not able to make it to like a prayerful place and designate time to pray it. So I'm using my fingers, my God-given mm-hmm. rosary, and doing mm-hmm. other things like taking a shower or brushing my teeth. And I get oftentimes distracted. I'm like, oh, I'll pray. It might be 11 or 12 Hail Marys, but I have to make sure that I at least get to 10. Would it be better to forego that and designate time, or is it okay to have a sloppy rosary?
Well, it is okay to do that, first of all. So the thing to remember is, as the Bible says, St. Paul says this in 1 Thessalonians 5:17, pray without ceasing, or pray always is another way to say it. So whether you're in the kitchen, or you're taking a shower, or you're driving, whatever it may be, that's always a good time to pray. Now, these are not mutually exclusive. So I wouldn't want you to think that, all right, well, later today I'm going to have time to do really quality prayer, therefore I won't do any praying at all before then. No, I see it as a both and. Now, my opinion doesn't matter. I'm just a guy with a microphone, so who cares what I think? Rather, I would say God says this, the Bible says this, to pray always. So if it's sloppy and you're distracted and, you know, you feel as though you weren't really able to put your full concentration into it, that's okay, because it's still prayer. You're still making an effort to speak to the Lord and to invoke his graces in your life. And then when you have those moments of clarity and you're free of distraction, so much the better. And, you know, strive to have those if you can. Not everybody can have those moments of clarity, because just the busyness of daily life. So if your life is suffused with your constant effort to pray, even if it feels sloppy and not very effective to you, it's still meritorious. So bottom line, I would say it's not either or, it's both and.
It's both. Perfect. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Susanna. Thank you. And I can only imagine how busy you must be with all the kiddos around. Lady Madonna, children at your feet, right? Let's go to Al in San Diego. Hello, Al. Welcome. Happy Taco Tuesday.
Yes. And yes, Patrick, I'm going out. I have petitions for school choice here in California. And I went to my parish and asked if I could get signatures. And okay. The priest told me, you know, this is a great idea, Al, but I don't have any kind of permission. Called the diocese, and they said, great idea. I think this is great, you know, that mm-hmm. we can put this on the ballot, and then parents can get money from the taxes they pay to put their kids to school. And they said, no, you know, we haven't heard anything from the bishops about that. And so I've been, you know, out there, you know, trying to get signatures and stuff. And I went to a Spanish-speaking church in our community. Mm-hmm. And right away, boy, that pastor said, this is a great idea. And so I signed up a bunch of people there.
So I know there's a question in here, Al, somewhere. There's a question. What is
it? Yes. And I just wanted to get your comment.
So in other words, if I understand you, you're getting signatures on a petition to put the a ballot measure on the ballot that would allow parents to choose which school their child goes to, as opposed to having to go to, let's say, the local public school?
Correct.
I think that's good, yeah. And you have the right as a citizen to be involved in local politics or politics at a higher level, for that matter. And so you're exercising that right. If the pastor of the parish has given permission, if the bishops give their permission, then I don't see any reason not to engage in that activism, because the goal is good and you've gotten the permission to do it. I don't see a downside there.
Yeah, I guess it's just the question is, you know, why are they really slow to giving this permission? It's such a great idea to do it. I know other states already going in that direction and everything, and it just, the church seems to move real slow on these kind of matters.
Maybe so. That may be true in any given place. But look at it this way. Like you just said, the pastor said, yeah. So I wouldn't worry about the slowness. If you've got a yes, then I would just go forward with a smile on your face. Good talking to Al, as ever. Thank you. Let's go to Joseph now in Los Angeles. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Patrick. Happy Taco Tuesday.
Happy Taco Tuesday.
Just had a question on wearing perfume and cologne, either at church when you go to confession or regular Sunday Mass. Is that a sin by distracting other people?
No, it's not a sin. I mean, if it's part of your hygiene regimen and you put on some aftershave, no, there's nothing sinful about that. You're trying to keep your body clean and presentable, and that's a good thing. It could become, I don't know if I'd say sinful, that may be the wrong word for it, but it could become excessive if you're doing it to, if you're doing it out of a form of vanity, if you're doing it to get noticed, if you're doing it to charm the ladies and you're married, you know, if you're married, you have no business charming the ladies, right? That's different from just putting on some aftershave and looking your best. That's a good thing to do. But it could stray into the area of vanity, I think, personally. Now, if somebody says to you, you know what, whatever it is you're wearing, I'm sorry, it just gives me a headache and I can't sit near you, you have a couple of options. One is you could say, well, I'm very sorry to hear that, and continue wearing the cologne, and somebody like that would sit elsewhere. Or you could try to help your neighbor out and say, oh, I didn't realize that. Well, I'll tone it down. Or I won't wear it to Mass on Sunday, because I don't want to give someone a headache. There are different ways you could handle it. But to my mind, it seems kind of a simple decision to make, that if you're wearing excessive cologne, yeah, dial it back. Or don't wear cologne to Mass on Sunday, if that would help the situation. Have you gotten a complaint like that?
Not really. The question came up yesterday that is it a sin in general to wear, like, in public, and no. I don't know, somebody passes by you, or you know, they enjoy the scent, and maybe the sin of lust may I don't know, creep into their mind or something like that.
Anything's possible. I mean, don't put it past anybody, yourself and myself included, you know, to be tempted by who knows what. But you're asking me, is it wrong for you to put on some aftershave? Okay. I don't think it is, for the reasons I just mentioned. Now, this is interesting. Let's look at it this way. I'll bet you St. Paul didn't wear aftershave. Of course, he probably didn't shave. He probably had a full beard. I'll bet you Jesus didn't wear aftershave or cologne. Now, it's interesting. He was anointed with perfume, by the sinful woman mm-hmm. who came and knelt at his feet and washed his feet with her tears and dried them with her hair, and she anointed his feet with perfume. So it's not as though perfume didn't exist. That kind of perfume, by the way, was intended for an aromatic aroma to combat the smell of corruption when a body was buried. But, you know, I don't think that Jesus or St. Paul or St. Peter or the early church fathers, had there been cologne available, I doubt they would have worn it, because it would have been, I think, in their mind, and I'm not talking about Jesus, because I'm just talking about, you know, his followers, I would suspect they probably would have thought this is sort of superfluous and maybe vain. But mm-hmm. I don't think it rises to the level of sin. I really don't.
Okay. And I just have one last question.
I'm afraid I'm out of time, Joseph. We took it right up to the limit. But that was a good one. I've never heard that one before. So you get a prize for asking me this question I've never heard before. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll be right back.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right, we are moving and grooving here on the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. How about Anna now in Illinois? Good morning, Anna.
Good morning, Patrick. I had a question regarding blessings of the rosary. So a friend sure. of mine received the rosary from a friend from Rome, and she doesn't know if it's blessed or not. So she was wondering if she could just ask the priest to bless it, because she's not sure. I'm I don't think there's anything wrong with a double blessing. But then she asked another question. She's mm-hmm. like, she has some rosaries from Kenya that she also received from another friend, but she's not sure if they're blessed, and she's praying it, you know, and she's like, but then again, it's probably my prayer, that's my intention, instead of this, you know, the object, if it's blessed or not. So what's your thoughts on this? Thank you.
Okay. I remember reading a story, Anna, of a Catholic priest who was a prisoner of war, or he was in a prison camp. It might have been a communist prison camp in, I don't remember, China or someplace like that. He made a rosary out of barbed wire, because there was barbed wire, you know, on the fences all around the camp, and he found a strand of it, and he made a rosary out of it, and that's what he prayed the rosary on. So you don't have to have an actual rosary to pray the rosary. It doesn't have to be a blessed rosary to pray the rosary. You could pray the rosary on your fingers, as an earlier caller was talking about. Also, a rosary or any other object, for that matter, can be blessed a million times. So whether it's blessed or unblessed, it doesn't affect the value of your prayers in any way. But because a sacramental, which is what a rosary, it's the category the rosary falls into, like blessed candles and making the sign of the cross and holy water, etc. These are things that don't have any power in themselves the way the sacraments do, but rather they help to dispose your mind and your heart to the things of God, to God and the things of God. So they're like little nudges that help remind you of God's love for you, or Our Lady's praying for you, and so on. So if you use them in that spirit, which is how they're intended, then whether it's blessed or unblessed, it doesn't affect anything one way or the other. Now, it's ideal if you have a rosary that is blessed, because it's all the more meaningful to you, but it doesn't change the quality of your prayer if the rosary is blessed or unblessed. Or if you don't have a rosary and you're just praying on your fingers. Or even if you're not praying on your fingers, if you're just praying in your mind, it's entirely fine. Everything about it is good. And so I'll leave it at that. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes, perfect. Thank you for the beautiful answer. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Thank you. How about Erica now in Imperial, California? Good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Patrick. Well, I have a concern, and see if you can give me some advice.
Okay.
I have a 21-year-old living with me. Me and my husband are very close to God, and he was too. But ever since, I feel like this past year he's been kind of drifting away from us. Mm-hmm. A couple of days ago, he was in a car accident, and I told him, I said, look, I don't know. I know God doesn't punish us, but sometimes he sends us lessons that you need to slow down in your life. that you need to think about what you're doing and the choices that you're making. Mm-hmm. I feel like he's drifting away from us. I don't know what to do at this moment. I constantly tell him, I'm not yelling at you. I don't want to be on telling you all the time what to do, but I'm trying to guide you the best I can as a mother. It hurts me see him, but sometimes I feel like I lose it. I don't know. I need advice. How can mm-hmm. I bring him back to how he was?
Okay. How old is he?
He's 21.
21. Okay. Well, I'm sure you and your husband were very good parents, and you tried as hard as you could to raise your son in the faith. So I would not, if I were you, blame yourself. Now, if that's not the case and you were negligent or lazy or something, that's a different story. But I'm guessing you probably weren't any of those things. So don't blame yourself. Mm-hmm. Another thing to remember is that, especially in this day and age, this is true in general across human history, but especially now with the rise of mass media and social media especially, and the rise of modern atheism, it's a very difficult time and place to maintain your faith unless you work at it, because there's such a strong corrosive environment that is, we're just soaking in it. We're in it all the time. And so for many people, unless they're making an effort to love God with all your heart, mind, and strength, it's easy to fall away. So this is happening to many, many people, including those who were raised in devout Catholic homes, who receive the sacraments and all of the above. So if you look around, you're going to see that other people are going through the same thing you're going through. It doesn't make it easier for you, but at least you'll get a sense of perspective. So it's not just your son. Now, the third thing I would say is that given the circumstances and his age, there's really nothing that you can do, quote unquote, to change the problem, except for show him good example, continue to love him, continue to let him know that you love him, and then pray your heart out for him. That's really the most powerful and effective tool you have. I'm sure you're already doing that, but keep doing that and don't lose hope.
Okay.
Are you familiar with the story of St. Augustine, who was a wayward young man, and for many years he lived the fourth century equivalent of sex, drugs, and rock and roll? Are you familiar with his story and his mother, Monica, who prayed for him so assiduously? Do you know that story?
Yes.
Okay. So then, since you know the story, I don't need to tell it to you. Look at your son like he's St. Augustine, and look at yourself like you're St. Monica, and look at God as the source of all graces, the way St. Monica did, and just be like her and pray all the time for your son, and pray that the Lord will send. I like to talk about a Philip because of the story in the book of Acts where God sent the apostle Philip into the life of the Ethiopian eunuch in a mysterious and miraculous way, and he explained Jesus to him, and he had a conversion, and he became a Catholic on the spot. He was baptized. And then we're told as soon as the Lord had sent Philip to him, he sent him somewhere else. And so for me, that's always been one of my favorite passages in this regard, because it's a great way to remember that even if your son won't listen to you, God will indeed send a Philip to your son that way. And maybe he'll send 20, 30, 40, 50 Philips into his life. You know, it may not just be one. So that's why I really recommend, maybe you can meditate on Acts chapter 8. The story begins in verse 25. But just meditate on that and ask the Lord every day, Lord, send a Philip into the life of my son. Send a Philip, and he will.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate it. You taking all my right. call.
You're welcome. Hang in there. Hang in there. Let's go to David now in Hammond, Indiana. Hi, David.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for letting me on your line here. The question I had, and nobody can really answer it, whether it's Catholic or Protestant. In fact, I was in a Protestant church not that many years ago, and the pastor of the church thought that I was wrong for even questioning it. And the question is, all right, so Adam and Eve were the first human beings.
Right.
How does one explain prehistoric man?
Oh, that's an easy one. And there's either one of two answers. Either before Adam and Eve were created by God, these creatures existed, hominids, and they were not human, but they were very similar to human beings in many respects. And then when Adam and Eve were created, that's when the human race began. Or the other possible answer is that after Adam and Eve were created, there was an extremely long period of time, because we don't know exactly when they were created, but there was an extremely long period of time within which there were these other forms, maybe a degradation of human beings, perhaps, or maybe an interbreeding, perhaps. That would be a scientific matter that I don't have, you know, data at my fingertips for. But I think that's probably the less likely of the two scenarios. I think more likely would be that these creatures existed for who knows how long before God created Adam and Eve. But I would say either one would explain, would answer that question.
It's interesting you call them creatures. They weren't human at all. I mean, they had...
Finish your sentence, David. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe...
You call them creatures.
Yeah. Well, you and I are creatures too, but creatures in the sense that they would be something less than human. So humanity, the human race, started with Adam and Eve. So if these hominids existed before Adam and Eve, no problem. They were there. We have the fossil record. We know they were there, but they wouldn't have been human.
And yet they were able to create these wall paintings and everything in their caves.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Beavers build dams. Bees make hives. There are all sorts of things that the lower animals can do. They're quite startling. Look at a spider web sometime and just imagine that little tiny brainless spider made that. I couldn't make that. So there's
okay,
your
Patrick. Thank you.
You're welcome, David. Appreciate the call. Let's go to E. Frank, waiting very patiently in New York. Good morning, E. Frank.
Yes, good morning. Hi, Patrick. I have a question about... the ashes that are used on the Ash Wednesday Mass.
Uh-huh.
I want to know, is it a regulatory process to use certain compository, the chemicals that are, well, the ashes that are used, are they actually from, as your screener indicated, from the prior Ash Wednesday that were
No, I don't know what the call screener may have said to you, but and maybe you misunderstood. I don't know, but the ashes that you receive on Ash Wednesday are the ashes of the palms that were used at Palm Sunday the year before. So as those palms dry out and get brittle, they're used, they're burned, and then the ashes from those are used on Ash Wednesday the following year.
Yeah, because I thought that you can use any type of material that was in palms for imposing ashes on Ash Wednesday.
That's a good question. I don't think that the church says you must use a certain thing. I think that the custom of longstanding has been that you would use the ashes from the palms from the previous year. But let's say you had no palms from the previous year. There was just nothing there. And maybe all you had were the ashes from a fire, a wood fire. You could use those ashes if there were no palm ashes available. There'd be nothing inherently problematic about that. But the custom is to use the burned palms from last year.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. I understand.
Okay. You don't sound convinced, but hopefully that got you a little more info. Thank you. How about David now in Oakland, California? Good morning, David.
Morning, Patrick. You know, you took a call yesterday from a young lady who was very anxious about receiving communion when she gets baptized. Mm-hmm. And it got me thinking about, I think that our RCA process needs to emphasize getting baptized earlier. I think by making it more, it turns it into an initiation, and I think people lose the understanding of baptism washing away sin. There should be more urgency around wanting to be cleansed of sin.
When you say earlier, do you mean earlier in one's life or earlier in the process?
Earlier in the process. Like if you're an adult and September rolls around, you say, I want to go to RCA. Mm-hmm. I'd say baptize them now. I mean, just like with Philip, right? The person, mm-hmm. and there's so much emphasis on original sin and teaching everybody everything. In the meantime, they'll live, maybe be living in a state of mortal sin for months, and then we write that off by saying, oh, it's okay. You'll have the baptism of desire if you die. I think that's a cop-out. I really think they should really rethink the process and help Catholics be more formed around the joy of receiving Christ and having your sins washed away as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I grant you this, David. There are times, and we saw one of them just now in Acts chapter 8, where a baptism on the spot is appropriate. But I tend to trust in the church's wisdom over 2,000 years. This is how it was done in the early church, too. There was a long period of preparation. The custom was not to baptize people instantaneously. And among the practical reasons was that many people would fall away. They need to be properly prepared. Just like you would, the airline wouldn't let you start flying an airplane because you took a weekend course in flying airplanes. You have to go through many years of preparation. Thankfully, it's not that long. Call again, David. It's an important topic. I'd love to talk to you again. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me.